Hello, everyone, and I hope you had an amazing time celebrating the new year. I would like to welcome you to the 14th episode of Late Night Crime Cast. I'm your host, Robin Steffens, and every week on Thursday, I'm going to post a new true crime story. I will cover cases that are local, cases that got a lot of media attention, and everything in between. I have been really interested in this next case for a long time because of how absolutely messed up it is. This is going to be an extra long episode because there's just so much to talk about and so much to discuss with this case. I'm so excited to share with you all, but I don't want to spoil what's coming up in this wild ride of an episode, so let's just jump right in. For this episode, we will be discussing the murder of Cindy James. On June 8, 1989, in a quiet Vancouver, British Columbia suburb, a body was found lying in the yard of an abandoned house. The body was that of a woman, middle-aged with blonde hair and light eyes. She had been drugged and strangled. Her hands and feet had been tied behind her back. To the majority of people, this would look like a clear-cut homicide. But to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they believe that this death was either an accident or suicide. And this was all due to who the victim was. A 44-year-old nurse named Cindy James. Now, to give you some background, Cynthia Elizabeth Hack James, also known as Cindy James, was born on June 12, 1944, to her parents Otto and Matilda Hack. She was the eldest of six children in an army family. And I say army family because her father was an army doctor who had the family moving around a lot. When she was just 1 year old, her and her parents relocated to Vancouver. The Second World War had ended, and her father wanted to move there to further his career. Unfortunately, this did not work out for her father, and he ended up rejoining the army in 1949, this time as a trainee, which meant that Cindy and her family would once again have to move quite often. There wasn't a ton of information on her childhood, but I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that she had a fairly average upbringing, even though she was an army brat. She was a very smart child who loved books and had a yearning to be a nurse. But as you would expect with her moving around so often, she did not quite develop socially the way she did academically. And in all actuality, her parents really discouraged her from making friends in the first place. I think this was because of the constant moving that her father's job caused. I think that in their minds, they thought that they were helping her, but they may have impacted her negatively by doing that. But Cindy, she had a good relationship with her parents. They weren't abusive or anything, but because of how things were growing up, she definitely had a more stressful childhood in terms of constantly being uprooted. Having to be the oldest, likely with the most responsibilities, and always moving around was probably not good for her. So, in 1962, when her father got approved to move overseas to France, Cindy had turned 18 and refused to go with her family. Her family still moved to France, and Cindy was on her own. After becoming this independent woman, Cindy was finally able to spread her wings and do what she wanted to do with her life. So she started to take a nursing course at Vancouver General Hospital. She lived on site in the nurse dormitories, and at this point, she was very happy. She had grown up wanting to be a nurse, and she finally got to follow her dreams. That, and she finally had some sort of stability, which was probably the best for her. And she still got to visit her family in France during the summers. So her life was very ideal at that point. Now Cindy, she got married fairly young. It varies from what I've seen online, but I've seen that sometime between 1963 and 1966, she had married a man named Roy Makepeace, who was 18 years older than her. He was actually married at the time that he met Cindy, but he ended up getting a divorce from his wife to leave her for Cindy. Cindy ended up graduating in 1966 as well, so that was a good year for her. She worked as a nurse for a bit, but quickly discovered that she loved to counsel children. So she later became the administrator for a preschool for children with behavioral and emotional issues. She was seemingly very happy with her life and career choices. Now, despite her love for children and her need to help them, she did not have any children of her own. And in July 1982, she and her husband separated. So there isn't much about the marriage that I could find, but I do find it strange that they were married for almost 20 years and never had any kids, especially with Cindy's fondness for children. But you know, maybe she never wanted kids, maybe he never wanted kids, maybe they couldn't have kids, or maybe there were issues within the marriage. Now there's nothing confirmed, but there were several instances of Cindy telling others that she was being abused by her husband. He said that he had only slapped her twice in their marriage, while the things she accused him of were much more. We will never know, but the way I look at it, they weren't happy, clearly, and abuse was happening. I mean, he admitted to slapping her, so either he was minimizing his real abuse, or that was all that happened. But still, he hit her, and so that's considered abuse, whether it's isolated or not. Regardless, in July of 1982, they separated, and then not too long after that, around 4 months to be exact, she started to get harassed by a mysterious person or persons. And this wasn't just normal harassment. It first started with phone calls. The first people Cindy told about these calls were her parents. Her father said that he thought she was not telling them everything about the nature of these calls, while her mother was able to recall what Cindy did tell her about these mysterious phone calls. Cindy said she did not recognize the voice on the line. She said it was just a voice. Sometimes it would change the sound, and sometimes it was just whispering. Sometimes it was just nothing, just silence. Nothing too crazy, but certainly not the type of calls anyone would want to be receiving. They started like that, but soon they grew to be threatening. The caller would say her name, taunt her, and threaten to kill her, imply that they could see her and her movements in her own home. And I actually have a clip of one of the calls that I'm going to play right now. So you hear that? Just very creepy, threatening phone call. And these phone calls got so bad that she decided to go to the police and report them. She reported the phone calls on October 12, 1982. The police weren't able to figure out who it was, because remember, this was in the 80s, and there was less technology to use to their advantage. So instead, they decided to come to her house and look around. They of course didn't find anything, but they told her that she should take notes on anything out of the ordinary. And they also told her to get an unlisted phone number. And you would think that this would help, but in fact, after calling the police and getting them involved, the harassment only got worse. Rather than just phone calls now, someone would come to Cindy's actual home. Just days after reporting the harassing phone calls to the police, Cindy and her friend Agnes Woodstock came back home from dinner, and what did they see? Cindy's door was slightly ajar, and a window of hers was broken. In her bedroom, her pillows were slashed open. This happened and was reported on October 19th, 1982, and things just continued to get worse. Cindy could hear people prowling around her house at night. She had her phone lines cut and her porch lights shattered. Notes would be left on her doorstep, and these notes would often feature creepy messages and cut out newspaper clippings. And she was scared before, so I can only imagine how terrified she must have been Like, I don't know how she would be able to sleep at this point. I can only imagine how this hurt her physical and mental health. So she eventually started getting police more involved. The more that the harassment picked up, the more she called the police. It seemed like an endless cycle. Finally, Cindy had started to get involved with the police so much that she met an officer named Pat McBride, who frequently checked in on her to make sure that she was okay. He even added a deadbolt lock to her door. He thought that her ex-husband was involved, but she denied that as he was one of the people who urged her to talk to the police. October 31st, 1982, Pat ends up moving in with Cindy. He says that he is protecting her, and he moves into a quote-unquote spare bedroom, but it's pretty clear that these two are together. Sometime early November 1982, Pat discovers Cindy's ex, Roy Makepeace, parked in the alley behind Cindy's house, armed with a handgun and a rifle. Roy claims he is only there to look out for Cindy. So Pat lets it go and they move on. But even with Pat moving in, the harassment continues. Cindy finds a picture of a corpse under the windshield of her car. She is still getting calls. She is still getting her phone lines cut. This is going on and the police are unable to find out who is doing this. December 1st, 1982, Pat moves out of the home at Cindy's request. They continue to date and he keeps his key, but he just isn't living with her anymore. In January of 1983, they finally place phone taps on the landline. Unfortunately, the calls are too short to really get any information from them. The harassment is still continuing throughout January. Then at the end of the month, the first big incident happens. On January 27th, 1983, Cindy's friend Agnes goes over to Cindy's to visit. There she finds Cindy unconscious in her garage with her arms and legs slashed and a black stocking tied tightly around her neck. So they call the police and Cindy tells them that she had been attacked by an unknown assailant or assailants. She stated that she couldn't see the attackers' faces, but by her account, she said that she had answered a knock at her back door and a man grabbed her. He dragged her to her garage where a second man was waiting. One of them slashed her hand with a knife and knotted a black stocking tightly around her neck, causing her to pass out. Cindy had over a dozen cuts on her arms and legs, though no serious injuries. One thing Cindy says is that she has a vague memory of being raped with a knife. And I'm unsure if she means raped with a knife or if she means at knife point. It is insinuated in all the research that I did that it was by knife, but that doesn't make sense to me. But nevertheless, they're unable to prove that she had been sexually assaulted at all. And so, you know, the police, they feel like she's withholding information about the attack. And I mean, the police, they end up feeling this way a lot when it comes to her reports. And as I mentioned before, her own parents even felt that with the phone calls. But now, this is so much more. Cindy later tells her brother, Doug, that the reason for this was that the men had threatened her and her family harm. So after that attack, Cindy received $4,250 from the criminal injury section of the Workers' Compensation Board. She uses that money to move into her old home that she used to share with her ex-husband, Roy. It is in February of 1983 that an investigator in the case, David Bauer Smith, tries to push forth with the belief that Roy Makepeace is the one terrorizing Cindy. He also believes that Cindy is still withholding information, so he arranges for her to take a polygraph exam. She fails it, and then she takes it again and also fails that one. So she then confesses to him that she did recognize one of the men who attacked her in January, but she refused to name him for fear that he would go after her family. Now, Cindy has already moved once that year, and in spring, she decides to move again. But it seems that she just can't escape the harassment. The calls continue, and she moves again for a fourth time. August 22nd, 1983, letters begin arriving at Cindy's workplace. October 15th, 1983, a strangled cat is found in Cindy's garden with a note saying, "You're next." Late October 1983. Someone destroys Cindy's garden. The verdict is out that Roy has something to do with it, but Cindy insists that he wouldn't have done this. November of 1983, Cindy's boyfriend, Pat, finds another note on Cindy's porch, followed by 4 days later, another strangled cat and a cat hit by a car. Pat convinces Cindy to hire his friend, private investigator Ozzie Caban. Cindy's phone lines are cut again. And sorry guys, I'm just summarizing right now because there is still so much to get through, so just bear with me. But January 30th, 1984, there is a second major incident. Around 6 p.m., Cindy phones her PI, Ozzie Caban, for help. He kicks in her door 15 minutes later to find Cindy on the floor with a paring knife stabbed through her left hand. There is also a threatening note. A black stocking is knotted tightly around her neck. She appears to have been struck on the head, and there is also a needle mark in her right arm, though no substance was found in her system. She cannot remember anything about the attack. February 14th of 1984, Roy Makepeace is questioned for nearly 6 hours by police. He claims to be as baffled by the incidents as Cindy, but says that perhaps Cindy's work with troubled children has invoked the anger of a family with organized crime ties. The police are unable to do anything about Roy, but he still remains the main suspect. On March 29th, 1984, Cindy undergoes a third polygraph exam. She passes. Summer 1984, the harassment intensifies. She is always receiving phone calls at home and work. There are cut phone wires, broken windows. She's losing weight and withdrawing from colleagues during work hours. It seems that these incidences are really starting to impact her. These things become clear as things get worse and more hopeless for her. Then on June 18th, 1984, Cindy triggers the personal alarm her PI had given her. He goes to her house and finds her back door partially open inside. When inside, he finds a sexually explicit birthday note and a cigarette butt. Cindy's small dog, Heidi, has been tied to the kitchen table with the same type of string used to strangle the dead cats found on Cindy's property. The dog is beaten to the point of bruising. Around July 1984, a fourth dead cat is found. Then the third big incident happens. July 3rd, 1984. At 8:30 p.m., Cindy notifies her PI she'll be walking Heidi in Dunbar Park. Now, why she decides to walk her dog through a park at nighttime will never make sense to me, especially with all of these things happening to her. But okay. 3.5 hours later, she ends up knocking on a stranger's door and collapses. She has a black stocking knotted tightly around her neck, and the last thing she remembers is being stopped on the street by a bearded man and a blonde woman in a dark green van. The man had asked her for directions. There are 2 needle marks in Cindy's arm, but no drugs in her system once again, aside from the prescribed antidepressants. Under questioning, she is confused and incoherent. So this seems to be becoming a pattern at this point. The black stocking, the needle marks, memory loss. So just keep that in mind. October 4th, 1984, Cindy and Ozzie, her PI, confront the police investigators about the lack of progress on the case. They threaten to take political action or go to the press. The detectives explain that there just simply aren't any more leads in the case. By this point, all of Cindy's co-workers and family, friends, they've been investigated. Roy has been investigated. He's been questioned as well. Police have secretly staked out Cindy's house for days without seeing anything suspicious. So at this point, I can't really blame them because there is nothing more that they can do unless they get more leads somehow. This has been going on for a long time, and it just seems that every time this mysterious person or persons does something, they're able to evade the police. So Cindy tries to go on with her normal life, and things are actually calm for a while. November, she doesn't have anything to report, and the harassment has finally let up. until December, when the phone calls resume. This is going on and on, still no progress being made on the case, and it seems like there's really little that can be done. So, June 21st, 1985, Cindy overdoses on pills in an apparent suicide attempt. She is taken into the hospital and is released less than a week later after promising to stay with her brother. She goes home instead. There is no reason given for this. You would think that due to her mental state, you know, someone who just attempted to kill themselves, someone would have made sure that she went where she was supposed to go, but I guess not. And then also on her side, you know, from her point of view, I have no idea why she would want to go back to her house when I'm sure her brother would gladly have taken her in and, you know, there would be less chance of her being harassed. But, you know, I couldn't honestly tell you what her thought process was during this time, but you know, we'll get back into that further into this story. So June 27th, 1985, her phone lines are cut again. She had ignored the phone company's recommendation to have the wires encased in protective plastic. Now, by this time, police are getting very tired of the constant calls and the constant reports from Cindy. And they actually start to grow suspicious of her and her intentions. July 1985, a week-long police stakeout is conducted on Cindy and Roy. This involves 14 officers. The officers observe no suspicious activity. Sometime in mid-July 1985, Cindy reports a silent phone call to the police. She's apparently unaware that the phone call was recorded by the phone company and that this recording indicated that she had dialed her own number. So, that's a bit strange, right? The police, of course, are taking note of this and starting to believe that maybe something isn't right with Cindy's claims. Clearly, Cindy doesn't know what the police had found, and so the harassment, it just goes on. July 27th, 1985, Cindy receives a cosmetic case full of rancid meat in the mail. August 5th, 1985, she reports the first of three arsons at her home. The first fire is in the basement and a basement window is open, but there are no signs of forced entry. Nothing to say that someone broke in, and so that's very suspicious to the police. And I don't know if at this point the police are starting to look more into Cindy, but it definitely seems that things are not looking good for the police's opinion on her. Just a day after, on August 6, 1985, it's the second arson. An investigator on her case begins to suspect that she isn't being completely honest with him. He asks another detective, Detective Carol Holliday, to review the case and render her opinion on it. Holliday concludes that Cindy is staging the incidents herself. This had been suspected as far back as the first attack in 1983, when Cindy had failed her first two polygraph exams, but clearly polygraphs aren't perfect, so they didn't pursue it. But now, feeling that they had more proof to back up her staging these events herself, the police were definitely starting to think that she was doing these things. August 21st, 1985, there's the third arson. Again, the open window doesn't appear to have been forced open. Dust and cobwebs are undisturbed. Basically, there just doesn't seem to be anything to indicate someone outside of the house is doing this. And Cindy is the only one living at her residence. So she receives over $9,500 from her insurance company due to these arsons. And on December 1st, it's assumed that she uses this money to move again. And not too long after, on December 11th, 1985, there is the fourth major incident. Cindy is found wandering around a pond near a university campus without shoes or a coat after going missing during her lunch break. She is just wearing a man's work boot and glove and is suffering from hypothermia. A black stocking is knotted around her throat. There is a needle mark on her arm. Once again, she is incoherent and confused and unable to remember anything about the incident. After this incident, Detective Holliday consults a psychiatrist named Anthony Marcus. He also has the opinion that Cindy engineered the harassment herself. And so police bring this to Cindy's attention and declined to press criminal mischief charges if she agrees to enter therapy, which she ends up not doing. Instead, she continues informal sessions with an unlicensed therapist named Connolly. For the first time since the incidents began, Cindy is surrounded by more doubters than believers. Her parents, her PI, and a handful of close friends remain convinced that someone is harassing her, but the police no longer accept her reports like they normally would. They think that she is making these events up so that they start treating her and all of her reports as if they are made up. And here, I guess I'll mention that I have no idea when Cindy and Pat McBride, the cop who she had dated, I have no idea when they broke up, but I'm curious as to whether their relationship had any impact on how her reports were starting to be taken. But I have no idea if it's even relevant to this point. I was unable to find out exactly when they had broken up. So back to the story. April 15th, 1986, after yet another fire arson, investigators determined that the fire was started from inside the house. Cindy accused Roy of starting the fire, but she didn't know that he was actually in a different country at the time. Cindy ends up getting evicted from this house and is given a 6-month leave of absence from work due to her being depressed and suicidal. That same month, she is committed to St. Paul's Hospital, where a psychologist reviews her file and classes the attacks and arsons as psychotic behavior on the part of Cindy. A doctor called Dr. Soon Moo and psychologist Ken Durkel reach the same conclusion. Psychiatrist Wesley Friesen believe Connolly, who is her other therapist, his insistence that the harassment was real hampered Cindy's treatment, and they consider it possible that Cindy could kill herself and stage it to look like murder so that Roy Makepeace will be blamed. Connolly himself agrees. July 15th, 1986, Cindy is released from the psychiatric ward and enters therapy with a different doctor named Dr. Friesen. She shows improvement throughout the summer. In September, she buys a house, and in October, she changes her last name to James. November, Cindy is actually fired from her job for poor work performance after working there for over 10 years. She had loved working with children, so this was a huge blow to her. But, you know, she got back on her feet and she took some refresher courses in nursing, and she's hired on as a nurse. Things seem to be fine for nearly a year. Then the harassment comes back. Late August of 1987, she reports a broken window and a window pried open. Early September of 1987, she reports a hole cut in a window. February of 1988, she reports her basement door broken. These events are spaced out for the most part until October 26th, 1988. That's when the fifth major incident takes place. At midnight, Cindy triggers the alarm given to her by her PI. He finds her in her garage, partially nude, with a black stocking knotted around her neck and her hands and feet bound with another stocking. She tells him and police that she had been grabbed from behind while getting out of her car. April 1989, there is a reported threatening note and a break-in attempt. May 1989, she tells Ozzy, her PI, that she wants to install an infrared alarm system in her backyard to shoot any intruders. It's unknown whether or not she actually really had a gun or meant what she said, and it's also unknown what prompted this after so many years. But something else that Cindy does tell him is that she's ready to talk, implying that she has been withholding information. But then it's May 26, 1989, and Cindy begins a 5-day vacation from her job. She runs a few errands, including buying a gift for a friend's son and getting a makeover. Then her friend, Agnes, and her husband, they arrive to her home to play bridge with her at 10 p.m. And even though they had planned this, Cindy and her car are gone. They end up finding the car in the parking lot of a local Safeway. Cindy is nowhere to be found, and inside the car are groceries and a wrapped gift. There is blood on the driver's side door and items from her wallet under the car. She is reported missing and is missing for 2 weeks, until June 8th, 1989. a road maintenance worker finds her body near an abandoned house, roughly 1 mile from where her car was parked. It appeared that she was murdered. She was lying on her side on the ground, fully clothed, with hands and feet bound behind her back. There is a needle mark in one arm, and an autopsy reveals she died from a drug overdose of morphine and other drugs. Because of her history with the police, they believe that her death was either an accident or suicide. Other people are unsure what to believe, that she really did this to herself, or that someone else did this to her. Her PI, family, and friends believe that she could not have committed suicide and that someone murdered her. The way she was tied up, also accompanied with the fact that she was actually overdosing from drugs at the time, was their biggest indicator. And I agree. It was reported that she was tied up rather tightly, hog-tied at that. Would someone overdosing on drugs be able to do that to themselves? Then there is the other argument, that she had allegedly staged crime scenes before, overused police resources, and created this entire situation in her own mind, and that she would go so far as to killing herself to get people to believe it. Her ex-husband Roy, who was often a suspect of these crimes, seemed to believe that she had multiple personality disorder and did not even know that she was doing this to herself. Regardless of that, her death was not considered suicide or homicide. The coroner determined that she died of an unknown event. Guys believe that for years Cindy stalked herself and staged all of these incidents, or that she was actually being stalked all this time, or maybe even a bit of both. Either way, it's a sad story. Either this girl was really being stalked for all those years and whoever did this to her got away with it, or she was just a very mentally ill person. So I guess I'm just gonna have to leave you with those thoughts tonight. I hope you guys enjoyed tonight's longer than usual episode, and I hope you tune in again next week. Bye.